The 1996 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 154, From Harlem to Hoboken, Pages from a Mormon Dutch Immigrant Diary by William Mulder, with comments by Karen Anderson England. Please note that because this is a 60-minute session, the last 30 minutes on the second side of this tape will be blank.
Greetings. I guess we'll get started. This is the session entitled From Harlem to Hoboken, Pages from a Mormon Dutch Immigrant Diary. To be given by Bill Mulder. My name is Steve Haslam. When Sunstone called me a few weeks ago and asked me if I would chair another session this year, I said, yes, I'd be happy to. And they said, do you mind if it's anything controversial? And I said, no. I'm on good terms with my bishop and my stake president. From the size of the crowd, I would say that this is not a real controversial subject, Bill. So, anyway, I'm glad to be here. This is the second time I've had the privilege of introducing Bill Mulder. Bill has been a professor at the University of Utah for about 41 years, in fact, in the English department. Some years before that, he did his B.A. and M.A. at the U in English and went to Harvard to do his Ph.D. In History of American Civilization. He edited a book with Russ Mortensen called Among the Mormons, Historic Accounts by Contemporary Observers, and I have a little connection there to Bill because my brother married Russ Mortensen's youngest daughter. He has also been the president of the Utah Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters. Is active in the Association of Mormon Letters. In World War II, he was a naval communications officer on Okinawa. And in another life, he was associate editor of the Improvement Era under Richard Evans, and once wrote editorials for the Deseret News. He also founded or helped found the American Studies Research Center in Hyderabad, India, during the years when he was at the University of Utah. My own connection to Bill has been more recent, although he was one of those professor icons on the main floor of Orson Spencer Hall that I didn't see too much of as a language student in the basement of Orson Spencer Hall. Never took a class from Bill, but he was introduced to me a few years ago by a colleague at Westminster College, Pat Coleman, and I've enjoyed this brief association. Following Bill's remarks, Bill's paper, we'll hear some comments from Karen Anderson England, who is also acquainted with Bill, somewhat through his daughter Emily, I believe. Karen writes a lot, writes essays, personal style essays. She has been the English department chair at Utah Valley State College, as you can see in your program, up until about a couple of months ago when she had her fourth child, and so she's on leave of absence. One thing that is not in the bio on Bill, which I think should be there, and I refer you to a Sunstone issue of a few years ago, Bill is one of the swearing elders, along with Waldemar P. Reed, O.C. Tanner, Sterling McMurrin, and several others. You were the only student in the Swearing Elders. Well, congratulations. And I see you're still a student. That's great. That's great. Okay, well, Bill, we turn it over to you.
Thank you, Steve. Whenever I see a meager audience, I take comfort in what Milton once wrote, fit audience, though few. I want to emphasize that the Harlem I refer to is the original Harlem with a double A. and not to New York's Harlem. In fact, the Dutch, of course, founded the New York Harlem. But that is now spelled H-A-R-L-E-M, and I've had a heck of a time with printers or whoever to remember that. The 19th century pioneer and immigrant diaries are a commonplace in American, especially Mormon, history. 20th century accounts of crossing an ocean and a continent to reach Zion are rare. Perhaps because the journey seemed both less hazardous and less romantic than in the days of sailing ships and covered wagons. Yet the later convert immigrants felt the same pains at parting from loved ones in the old country and the same anxieties on arrival as they dealt with the pots and pans realities of settling down in the new. My mother's diary, kept when she was 28, from the day she and her young family left Harlem, Holland, on May 20th, 1920, to July 11th, 6 weeks after arriving in Hoboken, New Jersey, provides a fresh glimpse of the convert immigrant experience in this century. All the more interesting because my mother, though limited to a grammar school education, proved to be a sensitive, observant young woman. Her diary, written with pen and ink in a neat, meticulous hand in a ruled 6.5 by 8 inch hardcover notebook of the kind she might have used as a schoolgirl, runs to 49 manuscript pages without margins, a bit of Dutch thrift, perhaps, to use every sheet from edge to edge. At my mother's death in 1977, at the age of 86, it passed to my elder sister, Anne, who placed it in my custody in the hope I would find time to translate it as a piece of family legacy. That hope has finally materialized. My mother was Fouquia Visser, Fouquia, F-O-E-K-J-E, a Frisian name, born on June 19, 1891, in Amsterdam of Frisian ancestry. At 18, she met my father, Albertus Mulder, a 19-year-old apprentice printer from Delft, in a small Latter-day Saint congregation in Harlem. Both with Dutch Reformed Church upbringings, they had, unknown to each other, responded to the message of a restored gospel preached by Mormon missionaries from America, and, captivated by the idea of the gathering, looked forward to going up to Zion from the moment they were baptized. They were engaged in 1910, married in 1913, and had to wait out World War I while my father served on border patrol with the Dutch Army before they could take the fateful step of going to America. Two children were born to them in the meantime, my sister Anne, for Angenietje, 6 at the time of emigration, and I, Willem, nicknamed Wim, nearly 5. Alone from my mother's older brother, John, the co, for Jacobus of the diary, already in the States as a steam fitter in the Hoboken shipyards, made the move possible. Making the journey with us was Ulrich, known as Henry once in America, my mother's orphaned youngest brother, who at 18 as an apprentice baker became the family's first wage earner after our arrival in Hoboken. The family could not go on to Salt Lake City, their ultimate destination, immediately. Paying back their immigration debt, a recurrent concern in the diary, and assisting the families of two of my mother's sisters to come to America delayed us for 6 years. Meanwhile, we learned English. My father, by good luck, after unaccustomed hard labor in the shipyards, scraping barnacles and painting hulls in the dry dock, found work within a few months in his trade as pressman for a large printing firm in Manhattan. Two more children were born during the New Jersey interlude, Mary and Albert Jr. In the diary, my mother records the illness, which marks the beginning of one of the pregnancies. My parents played active roles in the life of the Hoboken branch, a sizable Mormon congregation in the Eastern States Mission in the days B.H. Roberts presided over it. Oldrich, my Uncle Henry, within a year went on to Salt Lake ahead of the rest and established himself as a baker in Ogden, later in Salt Lake, and ultimately in Compton, California. In 1926, a family now numbering six, with, in addition, a Molly Higginson, a British convert who had become enamored of my parents while on a mission in the eastern states, set out for Salt Lake City in a four-cylinder, seven-passenger, second-hand Willis Knight that looked like a hearse. Its long body and small engine resembled a hearse. We formed a little caravan in company with the second-hand Hudson Super 6 with its square body, driven by my uncle, William Hoft, who had married Gertje, the younger sister, and was making the move west with their two children and a Swiss sister from the mission. Hoft got some notoriety as Big Bill for Wonder Bread, for Wonder Bread's long loaf. Some of you may remember that. When he worked for them in Salt Lake before the Depression uprooted him and sent him to Winnemucca, where he started the still-flourishing Winnemucca Bakery. Trekking west by car was an uncommon adventure when Route 30, the celebrated Lincoln Highway, was a primitive two-lane transcontinental road still under construction. When after 2 weeks on the road we reached the Utah-Wyoming border, Uncle Bill blew a blast on his old army bugle for pure joy. The Hudson wore out its tires by journey's end and rode into the valley from Parley Canyon's two-lane highway on its rims. After a discouraging few years, which included a brief trial as a fuller brush salesman and a series of stints in job printing, my father found success, first with Paragon Printers, then with Stevens and Wallace, and finally with a small partnership of his own called Mercury Printers. He was a popular figure in the Dutch community for his humorous songs and dramatic recitations, and he sang second tenor with the Swanee Singers, a men's chorus, for many years. In 1931, a fifth child, Patricia Joy, was born. I was in my first year at the U at the time, and I made her arrival the subject of a freshman theme so sentimental, my instructor called me in to say I'd been reading too much Dickens and recommended Faulkner as an antidote. In all the years of struggle, my mother renamed Fanny. The diary tells us when she learned that her Dutch name sounded improper in American ears. Ever anxious about debt, she abhorred installment buying, worked at various tasks to supplement the family income, from door-to-door selling of one product or another and doing housework even in her 60s to conducting genealogical research for paying patrons. She answered every call of ward or stake in a range of offices in primary, relief society, the genealogical society, and won a reputation as an angel of mercy, a peacemaker, a pillar of faith in the LDS community. The husband, who at one point in the diary seemed to be a closed book to her, was affectionate and loyal, but inflicted the greatest pain of her life when he fell away from the church, attracted by the occult claims of the I Am and related esoteric movements. I recall how fascinated he was by Francis Darter's numerology of the Great Pyramid. His disaffection was my mother's greatest trial, but she remained by his side as steadfast in her support of him as she was in her own faith. They achieved a golden wedding anniversary, and they remained united in their memories of Holland. They did, in fact, make a return sea voyage to the fatherland in 1955 and practiced the mother tongue with their relatives and survivors among their friends of yesteryear. My father died in 1963, a few days short of his 73rd birthday. His widow did not think she could last a year, but she outlived him by nearly 14 years, the center of a growing circle of grandchildren and great-grandchildren. After father's death, my mother made three visits of her own by air to her native land, one accompanied by her eldest daughter, the Anne, or Un, of the diary, who had married Leroy Glissmeyer and raised a family of her own. Throughout the years, the hand that kept the diary wrote hundreds of letters in both Dutch and English, and sometimes in a mixture of the two, an occasional faith-promoting verse. The penmanship, not as refined, but recognizably kin to the beautiful script of the diary. I brought some facsimile pages of that penmanship if anyone wishes to look at it afterwards. My mother's correspondence was the wonder of all who knew her for its fullness of detail and bright observations. Given the opportunity, she might have developed as a writer. The diary is notable for narrative economy, descriptive detail, and introspection. It is a model of grammatical correctness, too formal for what I had hoped would be conversational, and I have employed contractions, wherever suitable, to relieve the stiffness. There are few colloquialisms, but an occasional folk saying, and often snatches of dialogue which bring moments immediately to life. Tense shifts from past to present and back again, always unconsciously suited to the movement of the narrative. There are moments of pathos, passages withholding more than they reveal, rhetorical questions, anguished appeals to Heavenly Father, and a clear control as well as display of emotion. As much concealed as disclosed are the unnamed trouble with a friend, the concern about her relationship with her husband, a brother-in-law Willem's forgiveness for what? Recurrent entries record her observations of the beauties of nature, her trust in the appeal to her Heavenly Father, her longing for loved ones in Holland, her trepidation about what lies ahead, her resolve to persevere, her desire to repay her immigration debt. Among poignant moments are the family separation on Ellis Island, her finding precious mementos from home broken as she unpacked their seat trunks, her hurt when she finds her husband a closed book, and her disappointment when he does not have a surprise for her birthday. Joyous moments include crossing the Brooklyn Bridge, boating on the Hackensack River, visiting Central Park in New York City, trolleying down the Palisades from Jersey City to Hoboken, the sight of candles on a birthday cake, receiving news from Holland, hearing the prophet, the president of the LDS Church, Heber J. Grant, visiting at a conference, and gathering with the saints at home or in congregation. My mother found two small triumphs worth recording. The day her husband said the blessing on the sacrament in English, and the day she read the 13th article of faith in English. I wish there were a companion diary of the continental leg of the journey to Zion in 1926, 6 years after the family's arrival in America. But perhaps in this instance, less is more, indicative of what wonders she might have reported along the Lincoln Highway and what anxieties and aspirations filled the days that became her prolonged years in Zion. And now for a narrative summary with a sampling of some of the entries. The diary, together with an introduction and annotations, will eventually appear in the Utah Historical Quarterly, accompanied by a few photographs of the young emigrant family. I brought a few of those photographs with me. There's time in our session for only a sampling, concluding with the settling in during the first weeks of transition after arrival in Hoboken. The diary begins with a double entry marked May 20, 1920, because my mother had time to write only the day after embarkation. She begins with the mid-morning parting at the train station in Harlem, where a few relatives and friends from the LDS congregation saw us off for Rotterdam, where we would board ship for the transatlantic voyage. The opening sentence, "The moment has come to say goodbye," is weighted with the anguish of leaving my father's widowed and aging mother and his crippled dependent sister, Mean, for Wilhelmina, who felt bereft at our going. Anxiety about and yearning for them and for the old home thread the diary. "It was hard, very hard, to part from Mother and Mean," she wrote. "I had kept my composure all through, but when I saw Mean standing there so unhappy, it was too much for me. Sobbing, I left them, waving to them as long as I could." Arrived in Rotterdam, my mother finds the ship named the SS Rotterdam huge and stately. She describes the long lines of emigrants, Russians, Poles, Germans, even Arabs and Negroes, and the long waiting. After an anxious time, one doctor examined the hands, especially between the fingers and the hair. The other doctor examined the eyes, not very gently, mind. Luckily, all was well. End of quote. I'll do this for quotes. We can go aboard only at 8 p.m. We use our free time to visit an LDS family in the city. It's a long way off and it's raining hard, but we enjoy a most hearty welcome there and a surprise visit from members of the Harlem Branch Presidency, of which my father had been a member. My mother finds it touching. We are back at the dock by 7, and my mother's courage fails her. Again, we had to stand in a crowd for a long time. There seemed to be no end in sight. Oh, how gladly I would have run away back to all I hold dear. By 9, we go aboard, but at sight of the third-class cabin, she bursts into tears. Must we go in here? It seemed at first a prison cell. Jerry Tenhove, a fellow convert and close woman friend who had come along on board to see us off, said, "Let's make the beds. It's only for a few days." It was good practical advice and cured Mother of her tears. The diary describes a third-class cabin, 2 double berths, straw mattresses on springs. We supply our own pillowcases, pillows and blankets, our own soap and towels for the common washroom with its long row of wash tables with sturdy basins. "There's no comfort," Mother complains, "but we are lucky that our cabin is close by the lavatory and WC. She visits second class and finds how fine everything there is. If there's to be a next time, that's the way she would want to travel. The day ends with everyone exhausted. "We are too tired to think very much," she says, and quickly fall asleep. Henry, my 18-year-old uncle, wakes the adults at 3 a.m., to come and see the ship pushed by tugboats leaving the harbor. It's raining hard, but people are still standing on the wharf calling out their best wishes. The diary seems to echo in reply, "Farewell, fatherland. Shall I ever see you again? Farewell, dear ones, until we meet. Each hour now takes us farther from you." The next day, the 3, father, mother, and Henry, stand at the stern of the ship singing hymns with full throat, "As I love to do," she writes. "I often flee to my cabin when my longing overcomes me. I ask Father for strength that I might be a good support for my husband. Soon we'll be in strange surroundings." The diary records the daily routine. Up by 6 or 6:30, breakfast at 7:30, a walk on deck, reading and writing or play with the children. A midday meal, supper at 6, and to bed by 10, after some darning and mending and an entry in the diary. The food served at long bench tables is plain but plentiful, and the diary describes each meal in detail, whether it's bread and jam, pea soup, meatballs, and new potatoes, rice with raisins, or a Sunday specialty, corned beef. Cheese and pickles, when they appear, get special mention, as does bacon, which tasted so good. As a treat, we can buy oranges for 12.5 cents apiece, and we can get hot water to make our own indispensable Dutch cocoa. Entries describing the meals usually close with a comment, "Food is good, but always bland," or "Food is fine, and so is the service," or "We were given plenty." The family say the blessing on the food before leaving the cabin. The worst trial for Mother is having to pass through the throng of East European immigrants with whose general dishevelment she has little patience. They are filthy outlanders. She repeats her aversion more than once. Her uncharitable disgust must be rooted in traditional, rigorous Dutch cleanliness. By contrast, she praises the crew. There is great effort here to keep everything clean. The closing sentences of daily entries are invariably invocations, exercises in natural piety. One night, for example, when she sees the children sleeping so peacefully, she exclaims, "What a kingdom is ours," and asks Heavenly Father to watch over us this night. The unconscious piety is manifest in the entry for 23 May as the first day of Pentecost, and for 24 May as Second Day of Pentecost, remnants of the Christian calendar she religiously observed before her conversion. There's an unusual moment when second class passengers and people from the upper deck throw sweets and pieces of money to the children of the emigrants. The children fall over each other as they scramble for these things. And another moment when I attract attention as I set a tin wind-up toy, a Negro with dangling arms and legs, to dancing on the deck, unaware in my childhood innocence of the stereotype. Apparently I play dominoes to while away the time, and my six-year-old sister Anne and her inseparable doll catch everyone's notice. On the 25th, the fifth day out, the diary describes an enjoyable diversion. Mother, on an early walk about the deck, is asked by a crew member whether she would like to see this and that. "Yes, very much, if you please," and she is given a tour of the ship. He led me around and let me see everything, such as the printing shop, the kitchens, the preparation galley, the engine room, and thus he brought me to the foredeck, where I stood talking sociably for a moment with some of the crew. Close quote. My mother was a handsome young woman. I can understand the crew's interest. Throughout the 10 days' voyage, the diary observes the weather and the natural wonders of the sea, the seagulls continuously flying around the ship, hoping for food, the sight of England's beautiful coast at Plymouth Harbor, the sound of the slap of the waves and the murmur of the sea through a sleepless night. On the sixth day out, a sea smooth as glass, but a wind rising and white caps visible. And on the following day, the weather totally changed, the sea unruly and angry. At that point, my mother retreats to her berth, fearing seasickness, wishing she were home. She is grateful that her husband hurries below and does everything for her. She records that a heavy fog has settled down, drawing closer to the ship. The foghorn sounds continuously. "I end," she writes, "my energy is gone. Father, keep us safe from harm. Amen." But the weather improves, the fog is lifted, we see icebergs in the distance, a beautiful sight, and travel southward to avoid the ice fields. That cost half a day's travel, she notes. The days are long because we were awakened so early and then glad to leave the cabin where it is so hot. For a page or two on the eighth day, I, Billum, the nearly five-year-old Bim of the diary, am the center of concern. I have developed a fever. "Our Bim is not normal," she writes. "He has no energy and just wants to sit on my lap. He is listless, eats nothing. I hope that my darling will be better in the morning." Out of that distant past, I still feel that affection. And learning from the diary that a child in second class died that day, I can understand my mother's anxiety. The next day, awake by 3 a.m. and up by 5:30, she could record wonderful weather, a calm sea, and a beautiful rose glow lying on the horizon. And her little boy who goes on deck with Pa and wants to be carried everywhere is eating again. On Wednesday, May 26th, the sixth day out, my mother upbraids herself for feeling depressed. "Come, come, hold the head high," she tells herself. She finds good company in a fellow passenger, the mother of a girl who has befriended the children. "It is remarkable," she writes, "that such a good spirit prevails among so many different nationalities." But time drags. Everyone longs for an end to the journey. If the weather stays the same, we may arrive on Saturday. Thursday brings the fog and the fevers already described, but things look up on Friday and Saturday with a lot of sociability in the evening. Negroes boxing for fun, couples dancing, others singing. On Friday the 28th, the eighth day out, she records that every now and then we see the birds, a sign that we are closer to land. On Saturday night, the 29th, they receive word that all the Hollanders are to breakfast at 5:30 and be packed and ready on deck by 7. Saturday's entry, the final one aboard ship, closes full of worry, expressed in a series of rhetorical questions. "We are rapidly approaching our destination. Shall we have solid ground under our feet tomorrow? Shall we see Crow tomorrow? Has he been able to get a house? Where shall we rest tomorrow night? O Father, lead us on our way. Crow for Jacobus, whom we came to know as Uncle John, was my mother's elder brother who had arranged for their passage. There is no entry for the next day, Sunday, May 30th, but the entry for May 31st is headed Hoboken and recounts the momentous, at times traumatic events of arrival. Its opening sentence, "We are happily at Coles," belies a series of misadventures. After what the diary describes as an endless wait, we were taken to Ellis Island for close inspection. "What I endured there," she writes, "only my father knows." Father, of course, capital F, meaning Father in Heaven. I, a stubborn 5-year-old, added to her troubles. I clammed up when an inspector asked me to speak to see whether I were deaf or dumb. She was fearful I would not be admitted. Serich, say something, my mother implored and shook me. She was fearful I would not be admitted as an undesirable. Mother was sure that fate had befallen my father. When it was Albert's turn, she writes, he was given a big chalk mark on both shoulders of his jacket and was set aside to be more closely inspected. Upstairs in Ellis Island's great hall, we waited, hungry, all day. Oh, what anxiety that was. My waiting was one prayer that my beloved would be found in order. In such a moment, you realize what you mean to each other. Happily, there he came. It had been a mistake. How thankful I was. In family legend, the explanation is that my father's dark complexion, a very black mustache, and a festering thumb he had injured in the print shop back home made him suspect. We used to joke that a Spanish inquisitor had crept into bed with one of his ancestors. With our papers in order and Dutch guilders exchanged for American dollars, the reunited family were on their way just in time to catch the last ferry boat to New York. There, the diary reports, a friendly man approached us and said, "To Hoboken?" And we were invited to step into a carriage, the baggage on top. This is the diary speaking, we were under the impression that the man was a friend of Coe and that Coe himself awaited us at his house. But we soon had other thoughts. After quite a while and riding through ugly streets and impassable ways, we came to Grand Street, number 1409. Did Coe live here? I couldn't understand it, and I felt miserable. And I'm sure Bert, or Albert, my father, and Aldrich Henry felt the same way. The children were the best off and enjoyed the out of the ordinary. Albert rang the bell, and God be thanked, there came Coe. Oh, how glad we were. His first words were, "Couldn't you have let me know?" We looked surprised. As it turned out, Mother's letter had not reached him. He had wanted to surprise us, says the diary, and have everything ready, and now that fell to pieces. That was just too bad for him and for us. But we were here. That was everything. Joy quickly overcame the chagrin. Despite hasty preparations, Mother found herself too overcome to eat. Uncle John's fiancée, Amy, who lived upstairs, became the family's good genius, as the diary calls her. Family legend has it that Uncle John met her in a brothel, which accounts for Mother's later remarks that if we could understand each other better, we could see much in each other. She is clean and eager and not the way we had pictured the ladies. And I suppose we should read fallen women for ladies there. But Amy is like us. They became good friends, and Mother was sure Amy would make a good wife for Uncle John. Amy helped Mother with her English, took her shopping, and introduced her into the ways of American housekeeping. And it was Amy who gave Mother a new name because of the diary notes, my name, Fuchsia, sounds so strange here as an improper word. Amy suggested Annie, which became Fanny, because we already had an Annie in the family. Within a day of our arrival, Uncle John took the family to Secaucus to see the cottage he had bought and would rent to us. Secaucus, in 1920, was still very rural, reached by a suburban trolley that made its way from Hoboken up over the Palisades. Our trolley stop was at Farm Road, which led to Meadow Lane, where the cottage stood with its back to the Hackensack River and facing a pig farm run by an Italian family across the road. Rushes and wild iris flourished in a riverside swampy meadow down the road. The diary sounds idyllic. Oh, how lovely it is there. It is what I have always longed for, a cottage outside the city. We have had a lovely boat ride with Co on the Hackensack, she misspells Hackensack, Hackensack River. We are most thankful to Co for going to so much trouble for us and hope that he will never regret having helped us. In the midst of her joy, Mother could not help thinking of loved ones left behind. How would Mother, that is my father's mother, and Ming be faring? Wouldn't they be worrying about us? Such wonderings frequently interrupt the irregular entries for June and July, which are otherwise preoccupied with daily practicalities. When she sends cards to Holland, she muses, I should like to sit in a corner looking at them, meaning those left behind. At one point, she wishes she had some writing paper so she can write to Holland. At the end of the first week, despite the satisfactions of getting settled and having met fellow Dutch converts in a small Hoboken congregation, she records that the days seem long and I am homesick for Holland. If I could, I would go back at once. That leaden feeling doesn't leave me. Shall I ever on this earth feel truly happy again? I don't think so. My husband is to me a closed book. Heavenly Father, open his heart more to me so that I can be more to him. Oh, help me. Close quote. That entry, after all these years, throws light on why she felt so bad. But it's a key to a casket that is lost. We shall never know what secrets it concealed. Our speculation deepens at a glimpse of a further hurt in an entry for Sunday morning, June 20th. Yesterday was my birthday. I now count 29 years. I bought a pair of white shoes for $2. They look so good. Albert says they are for my birthday. I so much wanted a little surprise from him, but he doesn't feel it. But we learn that Amy saves the day. She baked a cake and burned as many candles on it as I am old. Those tiny lights were a pretty sight. The diary entries after arrival in America run from Monday, May 31 to Sunday, July 11, with considerable lapses, 8 days in one instance, 2 weeks in another, suggesting, as the diary itself says, how swiftly the time flies. As is so often the case, events overtake our capacity to record them. Those events might be significant trifles, dear as the heart's blood, as Willa Cather has described the run of ordinary lives. Significant trifles and a few highlights in my mother's remaining irregular record may, in the interest of time, be briefly summarized. 18-year-old Aldrich, my Uncle Henry, finds work at a bakery on his first try the day after we landed at Uncle John's. He earns $20 a week. In Mother's terms, a good beginning for all of us. Uncle John takes Albert, my father, to work alongside him at the Brooklyn shipyards for 54 cents an hour. One day they come home black. They had been steam cleaning the inside of a boiler. The change is very great for Albert, says a sympathetic wife. On the 4th of June, we move into the cottage in Secaucus as soon as previous tenants leave. That night, Mother feasts on the beautiful sight of the river, its evening red, and the lovely view overlooking farmland and everything green around us. The mood changes dramatically next morning after she discovers that the old mattress left by the tenants is infested with bedbugs. She vents an epic rage as she beats the old bed and throws it out, incensed at this assault on her Dutch sensibilities. When she goes shopping, she deals with peddlers or deals, pardon me, when she goes shopping or deals with peddlers who come to the door, she is as meticulous in recording prices, sometimes in guilders, sometimes in dollars, as she was in describing the daily menu on shipboard. A frying pan costs a guilder 27, a small pail 80 cents, an alarm clock 240. From one peddler she buys a house coat, from another a skirt for $2, and a blouse for $1, and underwear for her husband for $2.50. Quote, "He was a happy man," she says, referring to the peddler with all those purchases. "It doesn't seem possible I could buy so much." For a while they are living rent-free, and she feels expansive. But at the butcher shop, she keeps a sharp eye on the scales. "I can do more with $20," she writes, "here in $20 than I can in Holland." She quickly adds what a joy it will be when the time comes that we can pay our debts. The family go to Sunday school and meeting in the Hoboken LDS branch, where my father plays the organ and they encounter fellow Dutch converts. "We liked it very much," says the diary. "It is a nice hall, and the congregation is about as large as Harlem." Later, however, the diary complains about a bad spirit in Sunday school and members spiteful toward each other because one would be more boss than another. Sadly, Mother concludes, "We have arrived in a greater Babylon than ever Holland was. It is by no means Zion here." But there's uplift in her account of a trip to Brooklyn to a conference of the Eastern States Mission to see and hear the prophet, President Heber J. Grant. The trip itself is memorable, first by trolley to Hoboken, then by ferry to Manhattan, followed by a quarter of an hour's walk to catch the trolley across the Brooklyn Bridge. And very much, we enjoyed the spirit that prevailed there. The prophet bore powerful testimony of the gospel. The diary records an added pleasure, the unexpected encounter with a missionary my parents had known in Holland. Mother is thrilled that after 10 years, he still remembers her name. By the 10th of June, the steamer trunks have arrived, and Mother opens them with trepidation. She finds two blue saucers and the glass and a pair of small paintings broken. A broken sugar bowl makes her sad because it was a gift from Opu, father's aging mother they had left behind. The big family portraits are slightly damaged, but they are hung at once, a glad presence in the house. A marginal note on Wednesday, June 16th, after a lapse of 3 days without an entry, says that Albert blessed the water for the sacrament in English. And on June 27th, at Sunday school, Mother herself is asked to recite the 13th article of faith, her favorite about belief in being honest, true, chaste, benevolent, virtuous, and in doing good to all men. In her life, the article was more than a profession. It was a practice. The recitation went well, she says. "Oh, I am eager to learn English." Earlier, contemplating the pastoral scene in Sea Caucasus, she had been reminded of Friesland, her birthplace, her ancestral home. Even the language resembles the Frisian. That was a sound instinctive observation of linguistic kinship on the part of my mother. Frisian has close ties with Anglo-Saxon, ancestor of modern English. The diary ends with an entry for Sunday morning, July 11th, 1920. After describing a holiday family visit on July 4th to Central Park, which she found beautiful and so immense and free for rich and poor alike, she writes, "Wherever we are and we see various things, I always wish our dear ones could be with us to see what we see." It was a characteristic sentiment. There would indeed be many various things she would experience and share before her life was over. In this centennial year of Utah statehood, my mother's brief diary adds an uncommon yet typical page to the personal histories of our people. It frames a lovely and loving face among all those ancestral faces who begat us and made your life and mine possible. The original diary, I'm happy to say, will be preserved. It is on deposit with the Utah State Historical Society, accessible to whoever is curious enough to have a look. Thank you.
was a pleasure to read this diary this week. I'd like to thank Professor Mulder for his generosity in sharing it with me and with all of us. I took a great deal of pleasure in the presence of, in the renewed presence of a period of Mormon history that I hadn't really paid attention to or that I wasn't consciously aware of. I assumed, that the part of Mormon immigration that I'm familiar with, of course, is the more traditional history. To read an account from the 1920s was a very revealing and rewarding experience for me. I think what it must have been for a young woman to enter American Mormon culture, both in Hoboken and especially coming into Salt Lake later on, as a foreigner to a society that had been largely established, it must have been a very different experience than the kinship felt by the people who had come together over the handcarts and over the long walk across the continent. I wonder about the implications of that and what that must have meant to the people who were already here in Salt Lake City and those who immigrated in. I took a great deal of pleasure in Fukia's description of the steamship, of the English and continental coastlines, the ocean and sky, and the other ships. One passage that struck me very powerfully that wasn't mentioned here was on the tour of the ship. The sailor pointed out that their ship was at that very moment signaling to another ship in the distance. And the signals, I think, struck me as a very powerful metaphor for what we are understanding here, or what we're capable, what we're being rewarded with here, ships across the ocean, across the oceans of time in this case, very brief beacons, very brief signals to each other that allow us to understand each other and know of each other's presence in a way that, again, meant a great deal to me as I read it this week. There are so many things to respond to in this journal, but I wanted to just point out a few striking features that affected me as I read through. I had the privilege of reading the entire diary, and so there are passages that I agree with Professor Mulder were very significant, as he pointed them out to you. Others that struck me for my own personal reasons. One of Fukia's lines that struck me most powerfully was on Dr. Mulder's page 17. She says, "Oh, if I could only see the future for a moment." And she goes on to long to know what will become of them in a world where she is moving very rapidly into another world, into the future that she doesn't understand, very little that's predictable for her. My first thought was how ironic it was that we could read this journal now and look back on the past, and what was so mysterious to her is so evident to us. And yet as I thought of it later and thought of it further, I thought, no, the irony is that the past is just as obscure to us as her present was. In many ways, we have this tiny, tiny glimmer of a woman's life. We have 4 months of a woman's remarkable life and her remarkable mind and her observations. The rest is nearly as obscure to us as it was to her. We have the advantage of looking back historically and seeing the kinds of things that would affect her. And I'm sure Dr. Mulder and his family have many more memories that piece in the future that this woman was anticipating. And yet at the same time, I was struck by the strangeness of the passage of time and the mystery and the obscurity of the past and the present, and felt the very urgent notion to be very conscious of the moments that I live in the present. Dr. Mulder stated in this earlier session how remarkable it would have been to have a parallel diary of the trek from Hoboken to Salt Lake. I thought about that several times. It would have been a remarkable diary, and it would have been a remarkable parallel. And I'll talk in a few minutes about some of the reasons that didn't happen. Another place I felt a real connection with Fukia was that Dr. Mulder commented on her very beautiful handwriting. I don't know if you can make some comparisons here, but the handwriting is remarkable, and I think you should look at it after this. I felt her spirit in a very odd way last night because my computer broke down, and I don't think I've written anything by hand probably for 10 years since I wrote my thesis. I think maybe you can see some differences here and see the degeneration as it goes on. So I thought it was appropriate that I write my response by hand and make notes to myself in this way. I think that the poignance of the time issue and the questions of time and the elements of time that come to me as I read this diary are also really underscored in a funny way with a comment on page 19. Fouquier says, "Both my husband's and Ulrich's watches are broken, so we can't tell time unless we ask someone now and then." I thought again how artificial and strange time is, and yet how powerful it influences us. Another thing that struck me was Fouquier's incredible loss and the sacrifice that it took for her to come here, for her beliefs. I admire it very much, and I think the diary continually underscored how profound the loss was two generations ago, how much more it meant to them than it would to me in a day of, again, in an era of email and telephones and airplanes. I think, again, for Fouquier to wonder, think so carefully, what will the future hold for me? Could she have imagined flying 35, 40 years later, flying back over the Atlantic to visit her family and visit her homeland? And what were the differences once she reached there? And yet, again, our advantage in seeing this as a past event lets us see that there were some restorations possible, that in her lifetime, in her generation, unlike two generations of pioneers before her, she was able to bridge the gaps and bridge the distances between the two worlds that she had become part of. And yet at the same time, the losses were permanent. Her return 35 years later to her homeland must have been a shock. People that she had loved were gone. The landscape had been clearly ravaged by World War II, by a new generation of technology, by an entirely different place. And her return to Holland in some ways must have really emphasized what she had lost and what would never come back again. I was also struck by the loss of her first name. As a Mormon missionary in Georgia many years ago, I think the greatest loss for me was the loss of my first name. I didn't expect what that would mean to me, to lose the most fundamental part of my identity and become Sister So-and-so rather than Karen, the person that I was and the person I was familiar with, to discover on coming to America that her name was not only unintelligible and foreign but actually an improper word, must have hurt her and shocked her deeply. I felt the pain of that and the poignancy of that in several instances. Finally, what struck me most powerfully, and this may be because I'm very recently, again, out of pregnancy and childbirth, out of that experience, Dr. Mulder mentions that Fanny gives a very detailed account of the food on the ship. And she enjoys it very much, describes it in detail, talks about how satisfying it is, and one morning goes down and everything looks really repulsive, very nauseating. And from there on out, she is not interested in the food that is served to her. She can't understand why she feels so poorly. She doesn't understand her depression. And the darkness and the nihilism and pain that comes with the immigration really seems to come into focus at the same time. My heart was with her. My heart really extended to her. And I think that, again, reading a journal like this reveals so much more than the simple words and simple sentiments that were expressed. Finally, I guess my final observation was just on the nature of writing and communication in general. I mentioned the beacons that the signals that the ships sent to each other. Fouquier has given us a flash of light on a past world. Her careful eye for detail comes partly from a remarkable quality of her writing that I haven't seen commonly before, but it's something that as an English teacher I'm always telling my students to pay attention to, and that is to think of someone as you write, to really consider your audience and try and put yourself into their minds or in their hearts or speak the things that would mean most to the audience that you're addressing and find ways to communicate most effectively. At several points in this journal, she speaks directly to people in the homeland. She speaks directly to Mien. Mien? Is that, I hope I'm pronouncing that, Mien, Wilhelmina, a sister-in-law, thanking her for the eau de cologne, the perfume that she sent with her, and speaks directly Thank you so much. This is the most refreshing thing that's come along in a long time, basically, is what she says. She speaks directly to God at several points, as if her journal were an actual prayer, a written prayer. She speaks even at one time directly to her fatherland, as she calls it. She personifies her home country and speaks directly to this. She has a secondary audience, I'm sure, as she was pondering and thinking, maybe of her children, maybe of little Willem on the ship, who now is a venerable university professor. What it must have meant now to speak to the man who was her tiny son, and what that was, to her grandchildren that she'll never know, that she didn't understand, the people that she could only guess, again, as she pondered the future and tried to imagine what was coming. I'm sure she never imagined that this audience of strangers would hear her words and hear her voice. But I'm grateful for it. I'm very thankful for her generosity and her intelligence and her ability to express herself even for that tiny, tiny period of her life, to speak to us who now have the privilege of glimpsing a time and a place and a heart that is now past.
Thank you. I think our time is up as far as advocacy.